Session number 18822, Reel 6.
George Edgerton, Reel 6.
And the Major Fairgrieve, second in command of 10th Gurkhas, said the Japanese have retaken Tweetum Ridge, which is a beautifully sited position. From there, they can dominate the whole of the valley and the whole of the road for 5 or 6 miles as the road snakes down to cross over a small river called the Café Louis in local Chin dialect. And if they can augment their men with artillery, we're going to be in a very difficult position. So we're proposing to attack at dawn. You will do a left hook and reach the crest of the ridge to the left of the jet position, and I will take both companies frontally and forward. And he said, meanwhile, they are using grenade discharges vaguely aimed in our direction. It was by then midnight. I was astounded. I thought the march uphill had taken only a few minutes, such as my nervous tension, that it actually took 4 hours, and yet I was totally unaware of 4 hours of time passing, which is an indication of the amount of nervous tension one gets when you realise that you're going to be asked to do something, and I wasn't quite sure if my powers of leadership were enough to do whatever might be necessary. Anyway, we got there, and he said, "Go. The road is only 100 yards to your left. On it there are piles and piles of corrugated iron sheets brought up for some purpose which is now irrelevant. And get each of your men to take a corrugated iron sheet and get them to use their cookeries to cut a couple of sticks and rest the corrugated iron on it, and that'll give them complete cover from these Japanese grenades." Indeed, the Jap grenade was a very poor weapon. I was quite surprised. A thing like the 88mm mortar was an incredibly strong weapon with a terrific killing range, as much as 30-foot diameter, or perhaps even more. And being low trajectory, as soon as you heard the twock of the Japanese mortar hitting the firing pin, you dive for cover, because low trajectory would be over in less than 2 seconds, and you might get hit. That and the Jap medium machine gun, another superb weapon, very slow rate of fire, just tock, 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 like that, but just as lethal. And unlike the German Smeisser machine gun, which fired so many bullets and sounded like tearing calico, the Japanese machine gun conserved ammunition. They would just aim 4 or 5 rounds in a certain direction and then change into some other target, and use very little ammunition doing all this, certainly in relation to the thousands of rounds the Germans must have fired. And at night, of course, the Japs weren't wasting, you couldn't see what you were aiming at, so they weren't wasting either their 3-inch mortars or their machine guns on us. They kept them until daylight, when they could be 100% effectively used. But they used their rather unsatisfactory grenades. I can't think why the Japs didn't design a better grenade. After all, they'd been fighting since 1931 in places like Manchukuo, and the fighting had escalated, and they'd conquered the whole of Manchuria, which they then called Manchukuo, and then they'd moved down and attacked North Shanghai in 1937, moved on to Nanking where they behaved abominably, and they had got the whole of Manchuria and an area of the Huang Ho River from the Tientsin Peninsula up into deep, 100 miles or so, into Japanese held country, and they were about to do even more at the Yangtze, starting with Shanghai. And in all that time, they had never got around to redesigning their pathetically inadequate grenade, which, when it exploded, it only hit people with tiny fragments that did very little damage. And it was quite cumbersome to carry about. I can't account for... Let's see, by then the Japanese had been fighting for 11, 12, 13 years. Many of the weapons, the key weapons they used, were absolutely first class for infantry work. But the grenade, thank God, was a bit of a failure. And we did, in fact, get a whole lot of corrugated iron sheets and propped them up between us and the Jap, and nobody was hit at all. Not a single wounded man, although they were lobbing these grenades more or less continuously all night out of grenade discharger cups. And so we got what sleep we could, and we attacked, went uphill next morning, and there was a counter battery which, when we reached the crest, we were hit by a counter battery, and one of the my orderly's cousin got a shell all to himself. He looked as though he'd been run over by an articulated lorry. But that stopped. I'm not quite sure why. And then we went forward, and it was, the bridge was thinly held, and that astounded me, because I had a thought the Japs could and should have really made it a strong point, because it controlled miles of road going down towards the bridge over the Kafilohi River. We had no difficulty in winkling out the Japs. They got some small-scale bunkers just taking two men, and we only had to lob grenades into the apertures from which they were firing, and they were finished. And we genuinely did attack, capture, and consolidate the whole of that ridge with three rifle companies, two under Fairgrief and one under myself. And I think General Yanagida, who was responsible for that sector, I think he was sacked within 3 or 4 weeks by Mutaguchi for showing lack of judgment and failing to push his men and get more done. I'm grateful to General Yanagida's inadequacies, because I could score up one definite company success, which made a change, because I never again had any success in a formal attack, never once.
This was B Company?
Yes, B Company. We were still we got the ridge. Fairgrieve was very clever. He had, I don't quite know how, some anti-tank mines, and sighted them. And these next morning, these very light Jap two-man tanks came, and the first one hit one of the mines and blew up, and the rest were hit with them. We had some Piats firing a two-pounder shell, not very good, but better than nothing. And five of the Jap light two-man tanks were hit, and six went back. And if Yanagida was prepared to use his light tanks to retake that position. Why the hell didn't he dig himself in with more men in the first place? It's just a bit of unexpected Japanese commander inadequacy. That was held, and the whole of the brigade managed to move over the Kafue Bridge without any casualties, and we leapfrogged. our Gurkha brigade with the 1st, 3rd, 1st, 4th and the 1st, 10th Gurkhas, and there was a very strong brigade, 1st, 3rd, 2nd, 5th, 1st, 7th Gurkhas, and we leapfrogged over each other. Winkly out Japs who were astride the road or on a high position dominating the road. It took us till the 10th of April to reach Imphal, and they sent up a 3rd Gurkha brigade, the 3rd, 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 5th, 3rd, 10th on loan from 20 Div, and they did their share. So with 3 Gurkha brigades, 9 Gurkha battalions, taking on a particular Jap section, beating it, and then the next Gurkha brigade passing through and beating the next bit of Jap opposition, we reached Imphal about the 10th of April and dug in at a point called Bishanpur, 17 miles on the south towards Burma from Imphal, and behind us was another enormous supply depot, not as big as Dimapur, but pretty enormous, and 3 dry season airstrips and 1 all-weather airstrip. And it was crucial that the Japs should not get through our defensive position and dominate, damage or capture any of those airstrips. To some extent, all the Gurkha battalions were expendable, provided the airstrips weren't taken, and secondly, the supply dumps weren't taken. And Mutaguchi was so self-confident after his major success in 1942. Remember, he conquered an area slightly larger than the whole of France in 130 days. And he was so self-confident that he'd only given his men 20 days' supply. And he said, after that, you will live. They had a joke on Churchill rations, that any supply depot captured the Japanese called derisively Churchill rations. I didn't realise their sense of humour went that far, but that's what they called it. And to Mutaguchi's rage, astonishment and mortification, he never made it. The nearest his men got was 7 miles from the airstrip, and he did his best. He had very few aircraft, and he kept hadn't got very many bombs, but two or three Jap machines would come over and fire onto the airstrip. And once when I was there collecting some supplies, there was an American pilot. They were very good indeed, the American pilot, who'd been hit by ricochet. A bullet from a jet machine hit the ground, came up, and hit him. And he said this was intolerable, that he didn't mind and expected and was psyched up to coping with attacks from the air, but he just couldn't bear it if he was going to be hit when he was on the ground. Anyway, all these Japs, air attacks failed because every single machine was moved back to the Pacific, because the Americans having major successes there, and Mutaguchi appealed in vain and was told the standard Japanese command reply that the impenetrable bravery of the Japanese will prevail as they did at Port Arthur in 1905. That was one of their proud moments. Not only had, in the Russo-Jap War of 1945, not only had they blown the entire Russian fleet out of the water at a place called, a battle called Tsushima, but they attacked a very strong Russian defensive position at a place called Port Arthur, renamed by the Japs Darien later. It was a strong fort, and the wall was full of defensive firing positions, and the Japs were making no progress. So they sent 6 complete battalions, which were all in turn mowed down, but they formed a kind of mound of bodies up to and including the Russian defence position, so that the 7th battalion could climb over these bodies and get down inside among the Russians. And that was regarded by the Japanese as the correct way to win a war. And I can remember, I once saw a quotation by Colonel Hamilton, a British officer who was an observer at the Russo-Jap War of 1905, and he said, "I say again for the 10th time, but nobody will listen to me, the Japanese infantryman is the best in the world. He is well trained, utterly fearless, and prepared to die as simply as a matter of course, asking no more than the respect of his emperor and of his comrades in arms." And that was absolutely true. The Japs were prepared to do that. And quite often when they were short of supplies, somebody in Mutaguchi's position, or even Yanagida's position, would be told by Jap authority, behave as they did at Pearl Harbor, you know, attack a Lutrons.
Port Arthur.
Port Arthur, sorry, yes. Sorry. Anyway, given their due, with 20 days' rations from the 8th of March, they found themselves fighting with short of ammunition. March became April, April became May, May became June, the monsoon came down, and by about the end of June, all the targets had gone. Mutaguchi had hoped that on the Emperor's birthday, 28th of April, he would be able to proudly say, "We have Imphal, Kohima, railhead at Dimapur, and enough supplies to take us to Karachi, let alone anywhere else, you know, with these supplies, if there's no other factor involved, we could damn well reach over and meet the Germans in the Caucasus." You know, I mean, the amount of supplies available, if he had captured Imphal and Dimapur, was quite fantastic. With having started out with only 20 days' supplies, and then with very little supplies coming through, the Japs ended up barefoot, because their boots just rotted and went to pieces, and they couldn't get replacements, ragged, and above all starving, and again entirely without any medical equipment, so that if they caught malaria or dysentery or scrub typhus or anything, there's nothing to be done. They were just left to die. But by this time, our battalion, the 1st 4th Gurkha Rifles, by I think it was the end of July, had 308 men killed and 703 men wounded, which is a total of 1,011 out of a battle strength of 850. So so reinforced. We were very lucky. Somebody had done a very good job. I don't know whether they ever got any recognition for it. But because we had the airstrips, great reinforcements in enormous numbers of really well-trained Gurkha recruits came through time and again, so that we were never short of men, even though we'd had, since January 42, a total of 1,000 casualties. And we were still at full strength, a bit diluted for section and platoon commanders, but doing very nicely for manpower. They'd got some system where the 10 regimental centres gave the men a year's training, and then they were sent, in our case, the first and fourth Gurkhas were sent to a training camp called Saharanpur in India, where they were trained under jungle conditions until such time as the casualties were such that they needed at least a plane load more. And then those that got aboard the plane were really very well trained. So we were lucky. But there was one unexpected factor. The Teen Sarkar of Nepal, that is the Prime Minister, said that all our recruits were from recruit district number 4, which is in the foothills of the Himalayas, not too far from the route you'd take if you wanted to go the Kathmandu route to Mount Everest. And he said that not only had we had 1,000 casualties, but our sister battalion, the 2nd, 4th Gurkhas, had the whole of the battalion put in the bag at Tobruk, and nobody knew how many had survived, how many would survive. And the battalion had been reformed and retrained in Cyprus, that's the 2nd, 4th, and sent into Italy, where they'd had, I think, a grand total, including Tobruk and the Western Desert, of about 450 casualties, on top of losing 700 or more men in Tobruk as well. And the 3rd Battalion was fighting in... This is the 3rd Battalion from recruitment area number 4, was fighting with Wingate's Chindits, and they hadn't had all that number of casualties, but nobody knew for certain how many they would sustain. And the 4th and final battalion recruited from recruitment area number 4 was standing by, well trained, with 19 Dagger Division, and we didn't know at the time, but would attack right down to Rangoon. And the Nepalese government felt that this percentage of casualties among the young adult males in recruitment area number 4 was simply no longer tolerable. And our complete battalion was, let's see, in August, March, May, June, July, August. We'd been fighting about 6 months in that particular time thing. The whole battalion was moved to the northwest frontier, and put them on routine duties, coping with them, whatever the Afghans try and do most of the time on the northwest frontier. So by the time everybody, all the wounded and various people sick and people all came back, we were heavily over strength, and there was only an establishment of 12 British officers, and all officers over 12 had to be just pushed out somewhere. And I was sent to run the recruitment training battalion in the regimental centre, and
where's that?
Buckley in the Punjab. You go up to by rail to Amritsar Junction, and from Amritsar take the branch line to Pathankot, and then drive half a day into the hills, and before you reach the Class 2 hill station at Dalhousie, there's the Fourth Gurkha Regimental Centre. We had, you know, retired Havildars and Jemadars and Subadars combing the, going after retirement, going back to recruitment area number 4 and combing it for anybody who could be remotely suitable, sending them up to become recruits to cope with the loss of a complete battalion in Tobruk. More casualties in Italy, 1,000 casualties in our battalion, and more casualties of the 3rd battalion in the Chindits. Sorry, I've lost the thread.
You were saying you got this new job.
Yeah, and I'm afraid by then it was August 44, and we didn't know it, but the war was only going to last 12 more months, and I wasn't too happy with my job, but it did enable me to retain the rank of major. But after what had been happening in Burma and Imphal, it was a bit of a come down, and I never really got on with the chaps at the Regimental Centre. A lot of them had skillfully managed to spend the whole of their service without coming within 1,000 miles of the Japs, and there wasn't much rapport between me and them. But I tried to get on, posted to a unit which would eventually find its way in Java or Sumatra, but nothing worked. And so when the war ended, I applied for every known job in UK, the colonial service and God knows what, and my number came up, and I was flown to London. Was April, May 46, and I managed to get a job in Nigeria in the colonial administrative service.
Could I just interrupt
Yes, sir.